listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.
Hello, book lovers. You are listening to Words and Nerds podcast with Danny and Chris as your hosts. We chat to authors about their writing and discuss how social and political influences help shape their work. Our aim is to have a relaxed but in-depth conversation where we take the writing, but never ourselves, too seriously. If you like the podcast, it would be wonderful if you left a review on iTunes. The best reviews, or ones that make us laugh, will get a shout out on the podcast. If you'd like us to chat to one of your favourite authors, or you'd just like to say hello, you can email wordsandnerds@gmail.com. You can also find us on Instagram at wordsandnerds_podcast, Facebook, Words and Nerds Podcast and Blog, and Twitter at wordsnerds. This month's shout-outs, a huge thank you to Erica Books Always on Instagram, who says thank you guys so much for starting this awesome podcast. And Katarina Sanders, also on Instagram, says Words and Nerds is my favourite podcast, wishing you guys all the best for this holiday season. We have another one from Book Lovers Delight, who's given us 5 stars. We have another one from The Other Outlier, who's given us 5 stars and said it's a book lover's delight. If you're into books and authors, this is a great podcast. Hosts are easy to listen to and have good chemistry between themselves and the guests. The hosts are easy to listen to and have a good knowledge of what they're chatting about. A good range of books and authors covered also. Keep it up. Thank you. Another one from Dana, who says such a delightful podcast. Another 5-star rating. This is such a comfortable, chatty podcast. It feels like a casual conversation between friends more than an interview. Also, I'm so glad I finally know how to pronounce James Fahey's name correctly, and that was one of my issues too. Erica Books Always also says, I just finished listening to Beverly's interview. OMG. I absolutely adore Beverly. Who doesn't? And this podcast interview made me love her even more. I loved the making of Gabrielle Davenport and A Shining in the Shadows, and I can't wait for book 3. Danny, oh my gosh, I was thinking the same thing and even wrote it down in my notes when I read A Shining and saw that Gabrielle was written in first person, unlike in the making of Gabrielle Davenport. So I'm really glad that you asked that. Paula gives us another 5 stars and says, big fans of Words and Nerds. I love the relaxed flow of conversation between Danny and Chris and the authors. Danny has very obviously done her research and interprets the storyteller's intention and direction impeccably. I love Danny's understandings of the characters and themes behind the books. Chris has an impressive general knowledge, and both hosts have a fun, open and cheeky sense of humour. They touch on many hot topics in today's society. Worth a listen. Thank you so much. It means the world to us to have such amazing reviews in our podcast. Nadia Elking was born in Dublin, Ireland, and now calls Australia home. She is passionate about using stories to connect with teens. Nadia adores words and enjoys writing short stories such as Triangulo Amoroso, Disappointment, The Pika Pika Expressway, and Other Routes to Progress, and Dinner's Ready. Her writing has been described as raw, real, and heart-wrenching. Jenna's Truth is her first book. It's a gripping story which explores the themes of cyberbullying, teen drinking, sex, and suicide, and is a powerful tool to arm teens against bullying. A new edition of Jenna's Truth will be available from Serenity Press early 2018.
So, Nadia, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It's wonderful to be able to get to talk to you about the various issues going on relating to things like your book, Jenna's Truth. Now, it's a novella that focuses on cyberbullying and teen suicide, obviously issues that are quite prevalent in a wide range of society. How did the story come about?
A couple of years ago, I've got teenagers, and a couple of years ago, one of my my eldest child came home, and she showed me a YouTube video, and I don't know if a lot of people have seen it, but it was Amanda Todd, and she was telling her story of being cyberbullied with the use of flashcards, and then she died in 2012. So that was the inspiration for Jenna's Truth.
Wow.
Definitely check it out on YouTube. It's had like millions of views, and it's so hard hitting. It's really, really hard hitting. It'll make you cry for sure. Mm.
And so from there, derive this story, which did you intend it for educational purpose, or did that come about later?
No, it was written for really to reach teens and to when I heard the story of Amanda Todd and just saw that this bright, young, lively person had been lost to the world, I just thought, this is so awful. We just can't have this. And the youth suicide rates in Australia are really high. I mean, they are high in first world countries anyway. And I just thought, this is awful that kids should think that their problems are so insurmountable that suicide is a viable option. So, yeah, so it was definitely an educational tour. It was written for education to hopefully stop some kids from considering suicide.
I mean, I think personally from my experience, and I've got friends who unfortunately committed suicide through the years, and I think one of the issues that everyone feels when they're going through that, but especially I think young adults, is that inability to talk about things. And especially with young adults, that idea of, oh, they're just a teenager, they're moody. How much do you think in through your writing you're sort of seeking to address those sorts of issues and explain to teenagers that, you know, it is okay to reach out and talk at that point?
Yeah, definitely reaching out and talking. But the second edition of Gender's Truth, which is coming out next year, I don't know if you've heard of a guy, there's this guy called Kevin Hines, and he jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge almost 20 years ago, and he was one of the 1% people that survived. So he's written the foreword for the second edition of Gender's Truth. And his message is, when you're in that suicidal place, you just don't know that the problems are temporary. You can't see that there's a future beyond the problem. So just for kids to realise that it is temporary, and that even though you're in this dark place now, it doesn't mean that you won't have this amazing bright future. So that's like the message. Okay, it seems huge, but hang on. Because, you know, you just don't know what awesome stuff is out there waiting for you.
And when you're a teenager, these things do seem huge. You know, your three-month relationship seems huge and all those things are magnified when you're in that teenage space.
And not even being allowed to go to a party is like, you know, like a massive big deal. What am I going to wear? And she looked at me funny and, you know, oh, should I put my hand up in class? I better not. But then I'll get judged if I don't. I'll get judged if I do. So I think they really feel that there's this huge judgment on them, so that when the problems do come, they just feel so insurmountable, like they just can't tackle them.
And the book includes content and trigger warning, as it probably should, and obviously we need to be mindful when discussing these issues with our teens. And when you visit schools, how do you approach the critical thinking side of it, and how do you approach the conversation with kids?
Well, I found, because I've done quite a few school visits now, and I usually do a reading at the back end of my talks, but I'm thinking I should do a reading at the beginning, because once you start reading the story, you can see they're like everything's ticking, you know, like they're really switched on and they're listening and they're imagining the story and imagining what they would do in that situation. So I think the reading, just really read it, because I usually do this great big spiel about bullying and what to do and not to be a bystander and, you know, who you need to contact and all that kind of thing. But I really think that fiction is a better way of reaching the teens, because it allows them to fully explore the issue in a safe environment.
Yeah, and I mean, it's something else I think as well from the experience recently with Netflix and 13 Reasons Why. I think it's become a really interesting, not a hot button topic in terms of that for teenagers, but I think it's something that's being discussed more openly a little bit more. Is that something you've seen with your school visits and just your experience?
Yeah, I mean, some schools are definitely more open than others, but in my experience in Western Australia, the Catholic schools have been hugely receptive and hugely positive about educating teens about the dangers of suicide. And I've also had a positive response from quite a few government schools as well. But I really believe all schools have a responsibility to engage with students, and it's really only by having these discussions that we'll actually be able to save lives and make a difference.
Yeah, that's something that John Larkin, we spoke to John Larkin in episode 3 of the podcast, and he was talking about his experiences in schools, and he said the same thing, that a lot of schools are seen to be very uncomfortable in discussing those issues like suicide and suicide prevention.
Yeah, and I think they've got a duty of care. So oftentimes, like I've been to schools and all of a sudden they realise, oh my goodness, you actually might talk about suicide. And I get all these phone calls about, what are you actually going to talk about? And can you not mention? So I often don't even, I don't mention the word suicide, but it's very obvious what I'm talking about. And I just don't use the S word.
And I think, and again, as an educator, I actually think that a lot of the time conversations with students where you are sort of open about those issues allow them to sort of feel that, as we said before, those minor events that are in the scheme of things minor, which to them seem huge, aren't that huge, and help them to put things in a bit more perspective, especially if people are more willing to openly engage. Because the more closed off it is, the more they feel that there's something wrong and they're more likely to spiral off. That's sort of what I've seen in a classroom setting, at least.
Definitely. I would totally agree. And the fact is they don't have, like, we're obviously a lot older and wiser, and they don't have the benefit of that experience. And so if you have the conversation, you're able to share that experience and your perspective with them. But if you're not having the conversation, how do they get any information? Are they just going to get it off the internet? Is that how we want to engage with our teens, or do we want to actually sit down and maybe be a little bit uncomfortable?
I think it's hard too, because I'm assuming, you know, because of our vintage, we didn't grow up with social media, thank God, can I say. Imagine what I'd be posting on Facebook. And so obviously bullying was always an issue, but cyberbullying was an issue. And so how do we help the younger generation get a handle on using the internet properly as teenagers when we didn't have the internet as teenagers?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if we're the same vintage or if I'm older than you, but when I was growing up, really avoiding bullies really meant I learnt to run faster. Yeah. That's all I had to
do. Get away to school.
Totally different for these guys. And they don't have, like, it's not like the internet turns off at 7 p.m. So they don't get a break. Often when, if teens are being cyberbullied, I tell them not to retaliate, to screenshot evidence of cyberbullying, to block the trolls, and to make formal complaints. So if the cyberbullying is happening within the school community, the teenagers should probably tell a trusted teacher or their school chaplain. But if they wanted to make an official complaint, they can also get in contact with the Office of the eSafety Commissioner in Australia. And the website has a huge wealth of information on what to do if people are getting bullied. But the main thing, I think, one of the huge messages that teens need to understand is not to take the victimising photo. So often when I go out to schools, you know, if the kids are little, I get them to parrot back, you know, do not take the photo. They probably don't know what I'm talking about, but I'm hoping that I've planted a seed. Because the compromising photo is often what can lead, you know, to, like, it kind of almost snowballs. So with Amanda Todd, there was a compromised photo of her, and that was like the start of all her trouble. So, yeah, really, I really try and hammer it home to the kids not to take the photo in the first place.
It's the understanding that, and it's something that I've experienced personally, I think you might have had the same sort of experience. It's trying to explain the idea of permanence in a world that they think is throwaway. And, oh, that'll go away, or that'll... And
let's just take a moment to just say that line was beautiful.
Thank you. I'll take that. But it's something that I've found. And I was once in a conversation with students discussing Snapchat, and we were explaining to them that doesn't go away after the 10-second countdown. And there was this look of horror across the group as all these people suddenly thought to themselves, oh no, that means that photo's somewhere. And that was the message we were trying to get across to them, which was, if you take the photo, consider it's like an old school photo which is printed out. It is there. It exists. In fact, in many ways, it's worse, because it can be traced back, and you can burn the original and there'll be copies everywhere.
And you don't know where it's gone with Snapchat, do you? Where's it gone?
And it can be doctored, and it can be unsold. You know, but those images can be sold to all sorts of, like, dubious sites. And do you really want your face? Is that where you want your face?
Well, it's only been very recently that the courts in Australia have started really cracking down on things like revenge porn and things like that, and people posting compromising photos of others on websites for profit, as you sort of indicated.
Yeah, that's true. And a lot of that information is on the website of the Office of the eSafety Commissioner. So if people were concerned about that, that would be a great great place to start looking at the website of the Office of the Safety Commissioner.
But I think that at least gives them a plan, because when you were saying, you know, take photos, block them, then go to this website, I think at least if kids have a plan, then they can manage what's going on a little bit better, because otherwise I think it just gets too big and then people start sharing it and it gets kind of out of control. But if you have this step-by-step plan, it makes it far more manageable.
Mm. Yeah, break it down into bite-sized pieces. But it can, I think there's some really brilliant youth organisations like Youth Focus. They're the sorts of places as well for teenagers to go for help, because they're completely set up for dealing with youth.
And so besides the difficult conversations and uncomfortable conversations you have to have with students, which are really super important, what's really rewarding? What's a rewarding thing that happens when you work with young people?
Well, I just really love hearing their perspectives. And I'm especially drawn to the teenagers. You know, they're a little bit different. They love reading and they're just sort of not your cookie cutter mold of a teenager. And it's those teenagers that really make me pause and observe them a little bit more closely. I just love the idea that I'm maybe playing a tiny little part in their journey and maybe helping them along, giving them an encouraging word. And I love just seeing what they write. So I run a teenage book club for the Centre for Stories. And for those sessions, I get to be 15 again. And it can be quite liberating when you're my age to pretend that you're 15 and you can eat as much pizza and sugar as, you know.
I think there's a 15-year-old self inside us all, really. Haven't really grown up. Yeah.
I don't think I ever matured.
What I loved about the book was the glossary at the end. You know, being Australian, I understood every word you were, you know, writing about, and it didn't seem absurd to me. But I'm thinking about, you know, another sort of audience from America or something, and I liked the back how it had, you know, a number of words for the glossary, but speedos, slag, and gross. I've got to say, I've never been so proud to be an Australian.
Thank you so much. That's a high moment in my career.
That's the blurb for the next book. I've never been so proud to be an Australian. Done.
Be careful, I might actually put that in.
I don't mind. So did you create that glossary, or was that something the publishing company did?
No, I created it. And because we're working on the second edition at the moment, we've been revising the glossary, so I've been looking up budgie smugglers and other terms for swimwear.
I can't wait to see what you've come up with. And you have a blog as well, which I read, and it's got some wonderful reviews of great books. And what I found becoming part of this kind of Bookstagram writing community, especially on Instagram, it's such a supportive one. How's this community helped you in your writing career?
Yeah, well, I met, you mentioned Bookstagram and Instagram, so I met obviously I know quite a few writers, and some I've only met through social media, but even though I've only met them through social media, our friendships are hugely supportive and encouraging. Mm. There's actually a bunch of us on Instagram, and we're currently collaborating on an anthology, so we're rewriting myths and legends and fairy tales, and so we're aiming to, so it's bizarre because we've only ever met on Bookstagram. And here we are behind the scenes, busy working on a book. So it's going to be this global book that resulted from all of us just having Instagram accounts. It's quite bizarre. And I was just thinking, in WA, so that's sort of like social media, everyone's really supportive. But in WA, we've got a very strong writing community. I think in Australia we do anyway. But I found that if I'm ever stuck or I'm looking for advice, there's always someone who will help you out. And not only are the other authors incredibly supportive, but the independent bookshops are also really supportive of writers as well. So earlier this year I was very lucky to be awarded a fellowship at Paperbird, which is an independent children's bookstore in Frio, in Fremantle. And I was really lucky because I was given studio space for 3 months, and I was just able to write. Obviously, the bookstore was a huge distraction, but once I got over not buying the books and that I was there to actually write one, I was quite productive. So, yes, yeah, so I think in Australia we just seem to be super lucky with just how much people help each other out in the writing community.
And what I love about that anthology idea too is that, you know, especially along the writing that you've done, is that it's modelling positive reinforcement behaviour on social media and how social media can also be a big force for good at the same time.
Oh, so. It's amazing what you can do with social media. It just blows me away. Yes, there's downsides, but the positives are huge as well.
Use it for good.
Yeah.
I saw on Facebook that you were a judge recently for the Donate Life WA Young Writers Microfiction Competition. How does it feel to be a judge of writing and on the other side of writing as a writer?
Yeah, well, for the last couple of years, I've been a judge for the Ruby Award for the Romance Writers of Australia because I love reading romance. So I thought that was a good way of getting books without, this is going to sound awful, without having to pay for them. But I know. But the Writing for Life, oh, I just felt like it was an opportunity to give back. And I'm a huge reader, so judging really gives me an excuse to prioritise reading mm-hmm. for a few weeks rather than writing. And the process isn't really that much different from the editing phase of writing. So when I'm judging, I tend to look at the story from a whole, try and sort of step back. Does the story work? Are the characters relatable and likeable? Where does the story fall down? What about the technical aspects like grammar and syntax and all that kind of thing? But the only difference is when I'm judging is I don't have to make the edits, which is awesome. So I just get to look at it critically. But for me, editing my own work seems to go on forever. So judging is a lot easier than editing.
And you have a manuscript ready, I saw as well on social media, to be sent off to your beta readers. What can you tell us, if anything, about any upcoming work?
Yes, so the manuscript that I'm currently working on, which goes with me everywhere, I actually left it in the car for 2 days. My husband was like, what is it? You left your manuscript? I was like, it's like a year's work there, obviously. And because it's all, you know, it's even though the manuscript's bound, all my edits are handwritten, so I would have been lost. But that, I live dangerously. That manuscript, I'm really shocking with titles. So my working title is pretty naff. It's When You're Gonna Fly. And it's about a boy called Jake. He's in his final year at high school. He's obsessed with manga and anime and he has a talking dog. But his family life is just the pits. And his dad is really awful and there's like a ton of family abuse that goes on in Jake's house. And the story is really about Jake navigating the domestic violence in year 12 and working out if he can escape his life, really. So, yeah, that's a little bit about that story.
Mm-hmm. That sounds really interesting. What I'm interested in as well is the process of the beta readers. How do you find them and how much of their feedback do you take on?
Yeah, well, beta readers are like gold for writers. They're the people who read your manuscript and they can give you feedback and they... It's really hard when you've been working on something for a while to step back and assess it objectively. So the beta readers really come in there. That's where they come into their own. So my manuscript, the one When You're Going to Fly, the bad title, that one's gone to a professional who works in the area of supporting people dealing with family abuse. And then another friend of mine who's a teacher and a mother with teenagers, and she's also a writer who grew up in, unfortunately, in a home with family abuse. So she's reading it too. And then the teen book club that I mentioned earlier that I run for the Centre for Stories, they're also my beta readers. So those guys will read it and just hopefully give me an overview of whether or not it works. Do they like the characters? Do they, you know, more importantly, do they care about Jake? So if they don't care about Jake, I've pretty much just failed, really.
If they don't care about him, then, you know, the manuscript in the car could have just been taken. Just put it back in the car for a couple of days and just let someone...
Put it back in the car and leave the window down.
Just leave the window down with a note on it saying, please fix Jake, regards.
There's got to be a level of trust with the beta readers that they're not going to be too critical, but they're going to be honest enough to help you get the book to be the best it can be, I guess.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think, I don't know, with writing, I've been writing for a little while now and I'm kind of used... this is going to sound really sad, but you do get used to quite a high level of rejection. So even though I'll take people's comments on board, that's really not overly helpful to me. You know, I need someone to be critical. So yeah, there's a level of trust, but there's also, I think as with any professional, you have a level of confidence that what you're doing is on the right track. I did get some initial feedback from my friend who's a psychologist, and she said she loved the story. I did almost cry with happiness when she said
that. Here's another blurb. See, even more blurb.
Quietly confident that I'm on the right track.
So you talked about rejections and getting used to that as an author. What about your publishing journey? How has that been for you?
Well, so my journey's probably been a little bit unusual. So when I wrote Jenny's Truth, I wasn't seeking publication at all. I just thought I don't know, maybe pop the document on my Facebook page or something like that. But Rebecca from Orlexic contacted me via social media, another good use of social media, and she asked if I was interested in selling the rights, and I was. And since then, the rights have been on sold to Serenity Press, which is a small boutique press here at WA. And so the second edition of Jenna's Truth is due for release early next year. I did start to write short stories, so I've had a few of those published, and I just found out a few weeks ago that one of my short stories has been long-listed for the Margaret River Short Story Competition, which I was really chuffed about. Margaret River Press is a literary press here in Perth, and so it was a huge
honour to be long-listed. That's awesome. So you've got a lot going on. You've got the manuscript, and then you've got the follow-up to Jenna's Truth, and then you keep going to school. So you've got a lot going on. So that sounds fantastic. And I do think it's really important to keep that conversation going about cyberbullying and about suicide, even if people are uncomfortable about it, because the point is we want to help these kids. We don't want to, you know, we want them to talk about it in order for them to be able to seek the right help and the correct help. So thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
You can find Nadia L. King on WordPress.com, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn.